In the Gospel of John, there begins this whole series of chapters that there's often, you know, called the farewell discourse of Jesus, right? He talks, and it's three chapters of Jesus talking, plus a fourth chapter of Jesus praying, and whether that's part of the three chapters or not, I don't know, right? But we have this long discussion that Jesus begins launching into. There's actually this giant debate about this, and the giant debate is this. As you're looking at John chapter 13, right? John chapter 13 has the Last Supper story. And there's a break point at verse 13:31. There's also a break point at 14:1. And so the big debate is, does the farewell discourse of Jesus start in 13:31 or 14:1, right? This is a monumental debate among people that are professor types, right? Because you can see the vital importance in figuring out where to start this thing. And so professors care a lot about this. Normal people don't. And I'm on team 13:31. And so we have this sort of idea here of Jesus is going to begin this discussion. And he wants to start talking. And then we sort of say, well, what is he going to do? So Judas is there. Judas leaves, right? And then it was night. And Jesus begins talking. When he was gone, Jesus said, "Now is the Son of Man glorified, and God is glorified in him. If God is glorified in him, God will glorify the Son in himself and will glorify him at once." And this seems like kind of a nice way to start this, right? It's night, right? Judas has left, darkness is descending, and Jesus is saying, this is the moment. I'm handing myself over here, I'm going to be crucified, and this is the moment that the Son of Man, Jesus, will be glorified. God will show his glory. We've got this amazing thing that's about to happen. "My children," Jesus continues, "I will be with you only a little longer. You will look for me. And just as I told the Jews, so I tell you now, where I am going, you cannot come." And what's the first question that occurs to you? You imagine you're one of the apostles sitting there. Here's Jesus. He starts talking about all this glorification thing. That sounds kind of neat. And then he says, oh, by the way, where I am going, you cannot come. And you're sitting there having dinner, and he's about to sort of leave. Now, you've been following this guy around for 3 years, going all sorts of crazy places, right? And he's just said, where I am going, you cannot come. And fortunately, Peter's sitting there, and he asks the obvious question for us. In verse 36, Simon Peter asked him, "Lord, where are you going?" And it's the right question, right? Where in the world are you going? You've just said, well, I'm going somewhere and you cannot come. Where are you going? Jesus replies, "Where I am going, you cannot follow now, but you will follow later." And let's note, that is not an answer, right? I say, where you are going, where I'm going, you cannot come. You say, where are you going? You say, where I'm going, you cannot come, right? I mean, this is like this class, like, what are you saying here, Jesus, right? There's a real problem here with this answer. Jesus then launches in and starts talking about how Peter will deny him 3 times. Mark talked about this a while back, right? And so that's the team 14:1 thinks of this is why this belongs earlier. But he talks about that, and then Jesus finally comes back to this theme of where he is going in 14:1. "Do not let your hearts be troubled. Trust in God, trust also in me. In my Father's house," and finally we know where he is going, right? He's talking about his Father's house, right? Obviously, this is sort of where he's going to be going. He's going to his Father's house. And we know what that means because back in John chapter 2, Jesus rolls into the temple, right? They're having all this buying and selling of stuff, and he screams at everybody, throws them out of the temple, and says, "How dare you turn my Father's house into a marketplace," right? And then John adds, "This all the disciples then knew, well, this is the zeal of thy house will consume me." So clearly Jesus is going to his Father's house here, right? Now, this leads to a little bit of a problem. He's going to his Father's house. We know where the Father's house is, that temple over there on the hill. Like, why can't we go with him? But then Jesus continues, "In my Father's house," which we all know is the temple, "there are many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you. I am going there to prepare a place for you." And now I've got a giant disconnect. I know where he's going. He's going to the temple. But what is it? The temple's got a lot of rooms? It's like a hotel now, suddenly. Got a hotel temple, right? And here's Jesus going off to prepare all these rooms. He obviously isn't talking about the temple, which is what his Father's house is. So where is he going? And we got this whole puzzle going on. You can imagine the apostles sitting there wrestling in mind, like, going to his Father's house, got all these rooms, he's going to prepare a room for him. I mean, where in the world is this place? "And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, that you may also be where I am. You know the way to the place where I am going." And we're back at our same problem, right? Where are you going? And now he's not only saying, you not only know where I'm going, right? You even know how to get there. And then fortunately, Thomas shows up. And Thomas is like the underappreciated apostle, right? We often think of Thomas as old doubting Thomas and the terrible guy who doubted that Jesus rose from the dead. But Thomas shows up repeatedly. And in every case, I gotta be honest, I look at Thomas and I say, Thomas is a lot like me, right? Even the doubting bit, right? You all roll in and say, oh yeah, somebody came back from the dead, right? And my reaction, I'll be flat out honest, is gonna be, I'm not quite sure somebody just came back from the dead, right? I don't care how many of you tell me, oh yeah, I came back from the dead. I'm going to be like, eh, maybe, maybe not, right? We get this sort of thing we're talking about. Earlier in the story, when the Lazarus has died, right? Jesus is talking about going up to see Lazarus, right? Where Lazarus has died, not to see Lazarus. And so he's talking about going up there. This was a place that the Jews had previously tried to kill Jesus, right? And all the apostles were like, why are we going there, right? They tried to kill you last time, don't you remember? Jesus says, oh no, I'm going. And Thomas says, let's go with him so we can also die with him, right? And there's just something so realistic about it. And so here's Thomas. Jesus has said, where I am going, you cannot come. Peter tries, well, where are you going? Jesus says, well, where I'm going, you cannot come. And then he explains, where I'm going, you cannot come, and but you know the way to get there. And so Thomas pipes up and says, Lord, we don't know where you are going. And you notice he just says it. We don't know where you are going, so how can we know the way, right? And it is exactly the right question. In other words, you can imagine Thomas looking at Jesus saying, what are you talking about, right? I mean, this is like crazy talk. I have no idea what you mean. I don't know where you're going. I don't know the way to get there. I have no idea what all of this is about. And then Jesus replies, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. That sentence is one of those great sentences that Christians have been using over and over and over again for the entire last 2,000 years. We read that sentence, Jesus just saying steadfastly, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me. And we instantly think, I get it now. This is the gospel message, all in one quick sentence or pair of sentences. And you imagine the way Christians talk about it. We say, look, you want to see God? What's the way to see God? It's through Christ. Christ is the way, the truth, and the life. Nothing else is the way, the truth, and the life. And so how do we see God? We see God through what Christ has done. Christ comes to earth. He's God himself. He comes to earth. He dies. He rises again. And through faith in him, we can be saved. That entire passage in Romans is like an elaboration of this idea that Christ is the way to see God. And we want to see God. So we know it's by looking at Christ and seeing it and going through Christ. And we talk about this and we repeat this phrase all the time, right? And you get in church circles and we say this, and I dare say, I can walk in here and I can say, Christ is the way, the truth, and the life. No one can see God but through him. And you will all nod along and say, yep, that's exactly what Christians say, right? We say this all the time. We know what it means. Except we've got this really interesting problem when we walk outside the room. If I were to ask what it is that's controversial about this statement, for most of our time, in the last 2,000 years, there's all sorts of things that be controversial about the statement. Is Christ really the sort of the person? There's all these things. But I'll tell you the thing that's most controversial about this statement right now. If you were to walk over to Mount Holyoke and say, Christ said this, I am the way, the truth, and the life, where that all of the focus will be is on the word the. Because you go over to Mount Holyoke and you say, look, I'm a Christian. I believe that Jesus did all this stuff. And you know what everyone will say to you? Hey, that's great. That's true for you. For me, I've got this other thing that's true. You have your truth, I have my truth, and let's all be one big happy family. You got your truth, I got my truth. The idea that there is the truth is the shocking statement in the modern world. The idea that there's something that's true, whether you believe it or not, is just jaw-dropping to the average Mount Holyoke student. I have a merry time with Mount Holyoke students talking around, it's like, do you really believe that nothing is absolutely true? And I talk about, like, you know, get these small t truths, like your truth, my truth, and, you know, well, they're like little fake truths. But then there's this idea of capital T truth. Is there anything that's just true no matter what? And the fun thing when I'm talking to my Holy students about this, right, is they immediately all know the answer. Of course, there's no such thing as absolute truth. It's all just sort of this other thing. And I say, oh, that's great. So 2 plus 2 equals 5. And that's what I think. And you think 2 plus 2 equals 4. You have your truth. I have my truth. You have your math. I have my math. And then they realize, oh, no, no, math is different than truth, right? And I'm not sure how they are. And you can get into these great things. But this idea that there's something that's true, no matter what, That is just true whether I believe it or not. And if I don't want to believe it, that doesn't make it less true. And if I believe it or not is irrelevant to the truth of it. This is the stunning statement. Why? Well, this has been the big move in the way we've been thinking in the last 100 years, really. And you don't have to look very far to figure out why does everybody think everything's just so relative? And it's because you look back and you look at the early 20th century and you say, what is the single biggest shocking discovery in the early 20th century? Einstein rolls onto the scene and says, you all think time is this thing you can measure, and you're all sitting here for 5 minutes, and you think you know what 5 minutes means? You're wrong. Time is not a constant. Time is relative. If you're on top of a mountain and somebody else is at the bottom of the mountain, 5 minutes is different for the two of you. If you're traveling fast and somebody else is traveling slow, 5 minutes is different for the two of you. Time is relative. And I dare say, it's almost impossible for us to wrap our mind around the idea that time is not a constant. And it shocks everyone, and literally everyone, including Einstein, right? It's shocking, this idea that time is not fixed. And you can see how that sort of leaves people feeling a little bit like, well, if time isn't a fixed thing, if time, which we've thought we've experienced, is this thing that's sort of, it's a little mushy. And then along comes quantum theory. And quantum theory comes along and adds this extra dimension and says, okay, so electrons are moving around, but the way they move is probability distribution. And electrons here, it doesn't move to this place. Sometimes it appears here, but sometimes it appears there, and sometimes it appears there. And there's no way to predict where it's going to appear. It just sort of pops up somewhere. And there's no law that says, how are they moving? They're not really moving from one. They just sort of pop up here or pop up there. And they have like a 30% chance of being here, and a 50% chance of being here, and a 20% chance of being there. And that's the way the world works at its most basic level. There's nothing fixed at its most basic level. The entire world is just a dice roll, right? You roll dice, sometimes 3, sometimes it's 5, and it just sort of pops up here or there. And you've got these two theories now, right? And these two theories are both magnificent theories. They both have been tested empirically in about 1 billion ways. We know that everything is relative at the grand cosmic scale. We know that everything is probabilistic at the moment. These two kind of theories contradict one another, but they both have to be true because we keep testing them and they're both true. We cannot for the life of us. We've been 100 years trying to put this together, right? We don't even know how these two things can be reconciled. But by the end of it, you're staring out at a physical world that what's fixed out there in this physical world? I mean, by the time you start looking into physics even a little bit, you realize the entire world is what? It's a bunch of probability things with nothing really fixed. And so, I mean, it's just sort of, it's a really messy and fascinating world. And Christ rolls in and says, oh, you want to know what's fixed? I am the truth. 2,000 years before the theory of relativity, 2,000 years before quantum theory, it's like Jesus sits down and he says, you know, you think everything is a mess and nothing is certain, but I'll tell you the one thing that's certain, it's me. I am the way, not a way. I am the truth, not a truth. I am the life, not a life. That's the fixed point in the universe, Jesus is saying. And he's looking at these apostles, none of whom would have a clue about all the relativity discussion to come, and giving them this clue saying, look, you want one fixed point in life, here it is. And it doesn't matter what we discover about the physical universe, it doesn't matter what we discover about everybody else around us, all we can start with is saying, look, we know there's one thing that's fixed. And what's this fixed thing? Well, this is also what's interesting about what Jesus is saying. He's saying, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Why all three of those? Well, imagine he just had two of those. Imagine he just said, I am the way and the life. Left out the truth. Well, we'd immediately imagine, okay, so Jesus is the way and he's the life, and I kind of get it. This is how I should navigate my life, maybe. But is it right? Is it just one of the ways? No. And so he adds, no, I'm the truth. There's only one truth here. Imagine he left out the way, right? And he said, I am the truth and the life. Well, then we can imagine sort of our fixed lives. We know this is true, and maybe this is our life, but where are we going? Will we ever see the Father? Will we ever get there? No, he says, I'm the way. And then he has the life, if he left that out. He's the way and the truth. We can imagine we're sort of marching along the way, and we kind of have this truth, but what does that have to do with our life? Nothing. And so by putting this all together, Jesus is not only giving us a fixed point, saying this is it, this is the truth, it's a totality. There's this complete picture here. of saying, here is the complete set of what you can look at and say, here is the certainty, here is your fixed point. That has radical implications, right? Thomas Kempis, 15th century, writes this book, The Imitation of Christ. And in it, he wants to talk about this passage. One of his little, these are almost like daily bread devotional type things. And he says this, and it sort of starts in this interesting way because it doesn't sound like he's starting and be talking about this idea of the way, the life, the truth, and life. My son, as much as you can abandon yourself in your own will, so much will you enter me. And as to desire nothing outwardly brings peace to man's soul, so a man, by an inward forsaking of himself, joins himself to God. It is my will, therefore, that you learn to have a perfect abandonment of yourself and a full resignation of yourself into my hands without contradicting or complaining, and follow me. For I am the way, I am the truth, and I am the life. If Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life, and you want to live your life in accordance with Jesus being the way, the truth, and the life, what's left over? There's a totality here. And what does it look like? Without a way, no man can go. Without the truth, no man can know. And without life, no man can live. I am the way by which you ought to go, the truth you ought to believe, and the life you ought to hope to have. I am the way that cannot be made foul, the truth that cannot be deceived, and the life which will never have an end. I am the way most straight, the truth most perfect, and the life most certain, a blessed life and an uncreated life that created all things. If you dwell and abide in my way, you will know the truth, and the truth will deliver you, and you will come to everlasting life. If Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life, here we have a blueprint for our lives. Follow the way, seek the truth, live the life. There it is. There's our template, right? And again, I say all this, and you are all saying, well, obviously, right? We all know this stuff. This is nothing novel and exciting and anything. We all know, right? We ever come to you and say, look, you know, do Christians believe that Christ is the truth? We all say, oh, yeah, obviously he's truth. And what does that mean? Well, it means he's the truth. And it means, well, we should live the life and we should follow the way. And then what happens is we all say this and we all say, yes, this is it. He's the way. He's the truth. He's the life. And then we leave this room and we walk out and we go down to the grocery store. And you go to the grocery store and you got to buy toothpaste. And you see there's Crest and Colgate. Which kind of toothpaste should you buy? Well, you want to follow the way, the truth, the life, right? We know it's total, right? We know it's all-encompassing, right? And so, obviously, I want to buy the Christian toothpaste. So which is the Christian toothpaste? I mean, which one, right? I know, I really believe this and try. And we do this all the time, by the way, right? And I dare say you've all been standing there in the aisle, crippled with indecision about the toothpaste, right? Do I buy Crest or do I buy Colgate? And so what do? You come to church, we study scriptures, we really try to find the truth of the toothpaste, right? And then you imagine what we do in church, right? We get some people who are studying scripture and really deeply delving into it decide Crest is the toothpaste. And then we get other people who decide Colgate is the toothpaste. And then we got a big problem in a church because we got the Crest people and we got the Colgate people. And they're both saying, no, wait a minute, we want the truth. There's a few heretics running around that buy store brand toothpaste, but we don't talk about them, right? And so we have this, right? And then, you know, I have somebody pop up and say, wait a minute, like, you're talking Crest, you're talking Colgate, doesn't matter. And then you say, well, obviously it matters. Christ said he is the way, the truth, and the life, right? And so what do we need to do then? We need to find out the right answer on this. And so you go to the pastor. You show up in Mark's office one day and you say, Mark, I need to know which kind of toothpaste should I buy. We need to solve this grand debate. And he gives you an answer. Do you believe it? No, obviously not, right? I mean, it's sort of, we got this really big problem here. Who can solve this? So we go to Jesus himself and we say, Jesus, we've heard what you've said. I am the way, the truth, the life. And I need to know now, what kind of toothpaste should I buy? And what would Jesus say to you? I mean, really imagine it. Imagine the 12 apostles sitting there talking to Jesus at any point in that 3 years said, Jesus, what's the right kind of toothpaste to buy? What would Jesus have said? Would he say it doesn't matter? Would he say, I don't care? Well, I know what he would say. How could Jesus not care, right? I mean, it just seems weird to imagine. Would he look at you and say, you idiot, obviously Crest? Or would he say, no, it's clearly Colgate? I mean, which one would he do? Well, we know what he would say because he said it right in this discourse. Chapter 14, verse 1. He would say, do not let your hearts be troubled. Why are you worried about toothpaste? If Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life, that's enough for us to try to navigate the rest of our lives, trying to live your life being the life. That's a pretty big deal. And here we are obsessing about toothpaste. Does toothpaste really matter compared to everything else? And you realize pretty quick, toothpaste is probably irrelevant. And you're all thinking, well, obviously toothpaste is irrelevant. This is a stupid example. I know Claire's saying that, right? This is a stupid example, right? But you know what? We do the same thing with everything else in our lives. Here we have Jesus saying, I am the way, the truth, the life, and we start getting all worked up about all sorts of other things. Take politics. There's a political election coming up. You might have heard about it, right? And what do, right? We worry about it, and we get angst-filled about it, and we really study it. And then we ask ourselves, what should we be doing in this political season? And what does Jesus say? Do not let your hearts be troubled. And you know what we say? We say, you know, okay, whatever, right? Forget it. If Jesus only lived in 2016, does he seen what's happening in November of 2016? I get it. Back in his day, they didn't have to worry about politics. Oh, except Jesus lived in occupied territory, right? His country was being conquered by the Roman Empire, who was going to destroy the temple in the near future, right? There are a lot of... In fact, it's not even a stretch to imagine what Jesus would say about politics, because during his 3 years roaming around, some people walked up to him to give him the challenge. Should we pay taxes or not? And this was deliberately a which party should we vote for question. Should we vote for the Republicans or Democrats is what their people are saying. And the equivalent of that is the Romans are here occupying us. Do we cooperate with the Romans or do we rebel against the Romans? And they're asking him in no uncertain terms, what's the right political decision here? And what does Jesus say? He says, why are you asking me this, right? Pay your taxes to Caesar, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar, and to God the things that are God's. Which one matters more, the things that are God's or the things that are Caesar's? And you immediately realize what he's saying. He's saying, why are you bothering worrying about the Roman occupation? Why don't you worry about rendering to God the things that are God? That's enough for all of you. When you get that one down, when you've rendered everything to God that's God's, then maybe you can start agonizing about what to do about Caesar, he's saying. He's saying, do not let your hearts be troubled. And then on top of it, he's not specifically talking about politics when he says, do not let your hearts be troubled. What's the immediate thing that's going to be troubling the apostles here? Jesus is about to be crucified. You want to know something troubling? I'll tell you. The election in November, crucifixion of Christ. Which one will cause greater discomfort? Not even close. And Jesus is looking out and saying, I'm about to go die. Do not let your hearts be troubled. Why shouldn't you let your hearts be troubled? Because here's Jesus standing there saying, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me. There is a totality here. This is what matters here. This is what we should be spending our time thinking about and doing, and it's enough of a challenge for us just to be thinking about that. Early in John's gospel, he introduces the theme. John chapter 1, verse 17. John says this, for the law was given through Moses, grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. And he sets up this magnificent distinction. Moses handed down the law. Jesus Christ is handing out grace and truth. And what do we spend our days arguing about? We spend our days arguing about the law and not sitting around thinking, wait a minute, we have grace and truth. We have them sitting right there. We just go out and we look at Christ and we say, yeah, that's the way. I will follow that way. That's the truth. I will seek that truth. That's the life. I will live that life. And what will it look like then? Well, you imagine what's our challenge then. Our challenge is stop worrying so much about the kind of toothpaste. Just buy toothpaste, right? God probably doesn't care if you buy Crest or Colgate. God probably doesn't have an ideal tax structure for the United States in 2016, right? Maybe he has ideas on this, but I dare say we're not going to find him in the Gospel of John, right? But how can we know we're living the life that Jesus wants us to live? Do not let your hearts be troubled. What's the positive command? Well, he also gave us that in chapter 13, verse 34. A new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this all men will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another. You want to know the challenge for all of us? It's to stop letting our hearts be troubled by all the things that are out there, all these second-order concerns, and start loving one another. It's way easier to agonize about politics or toothpaste than it is to love one another. Let's be honest. It's really easy to agonize about things in life. It's easy to get worked up about things in life. Imagine you take all of the time we spend worrying about things, and we all do this. We worry about so many things in our life. And imagine we took all of that time and energy, and we channeled it into, how do I show love to someone else today? What a shocking revolution that would be. I mean, it would be stunning in our own lives. And it would be hard in our own lives. Imagine we said, you know what I want to do? I want to understand the truth that God has revealed. I really want to understand the truth, what's really true. Think of the time that we would then trying to find out what's true instead of agonizing about all these other sorts of things. Imagine living the life that Christ has handed out for us and the joy we could have living that life and not letting our hearts be troubled, trusting that God's got it all in control. And we really trust that God's got it in control, and we're going to follow the way, and we're going to look for the truth, and we're going to live the life, and everything else that's out of our control, we say, you know what? That's not what God's called me to worry about. He's called me to love one another, to love each other as Christ loved us. And you're all thinking, this is the same punchline as last week's sermon. And you know what? It is the same punchline as last week's sermon. Is that a shock? Here's Jesus about to go die. He's about to be crucified on a cross, and he's looking out at us, and he's saying what? He's saying, don't worry, don't be troubled that I'm about to be crucified and die. He's saying, don't worry about that. He's saying, what should you worry about? Trust me on this one. Love one another and follow me.